I'm gonna start reading Susanna.
Read.
And then when something, you know, perks your interest, say
scream.
So.
Okay. Right.
Okay, verse 1. There was a man living in Babylon whose name was Joachim.
Yeah, and so.
And that's how class. Yeah, that's how class works.
So, so where is the hearer, right? And if this is written in Greek, right, is the hearer in Egypt?
Yeah.
Or is the hearer in Palestine? Where is the hearer, and what does Babylon mean and stand for them?
Absolutely.
Right?
So in the first verse, you've already got some color.
Right? So if you're a fan of Babylon, right, and what is, but you know, and what does Babylon mean? And Babylon's a big, huge deal because for the bulk of the life for Jewish people, people start in Babylon and the book ends in Babylon, right? So Babylon is the framework of everything, right? You begin and end in Babylon, right? And you were exiled to Babylon by the Babylonians. And while there are some posts, you know, the Book of Esther is post first, you know, you've got some stuff out there. Most of that's not, you know, Ezra and Nehemiah are post that, right? So you've got some books that are post that, but the bulk of them aren't, right? You know, stuff comes to a big end in Babylon, right? And so Babylon stands for a whole bunch of stuff, right? And so, and the Babylonian Talmud is really important. And so, and if the biblical text is written, redacted, put together, conceptualized, whatever it is in Babylon, right? Then Babylon is kind of the theological and literary center, and also brackets the whole book. So by putting it in Babylon on some sick and twisted level makes it almost more authoritative, even if you're in Egypt. Right? And if Babylon for, you know, as we've discussed, in, you know, the horror of Babylon, right? Babylon stands for all this other weird bad stuff.
Right.
Then putting it in Babylon also carries with it this other stuff, right? So the folks in Babylon are kind of, we're just going to assume, bad.
Right.
But this little subgroup is, A, not leaving, so oops, I hate it when that happens, and B, sort of trying to make the best out of what's going on in Babylon. Well, yeah.
Wow. That's crazy how you kind of actually just, based on my interpretation, you know, nailed the core of this story, because Joachim's a stand-up guy, Susanna is stand-up, and it's the two Jewish elders with the Babylonian influence or whatever, you know, who kind of make things dirty. But if you stay steadfast, despite all this that's going on, God will, through Daniel, will vindicate you somehow. But I'm getting ahead of myself, but that's great.
Well, we were in the first verse.
Yeah, you're right. Well, I mean, that's how
it is.
You
didn't want me to go much farther. You said stop as soon as I say something.
You're right.
Okay, so read it again.
There was a man living in Babylon whose name was Joachim.
And even though it's a book about Susanna, right, it doesn't lead with her.
It's called Susanna,
The name of the book is Susanna, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about. She's the main character, but she's not a main character because she's a woman, and therefore she has to be, in order for her to be anybody, and especially in order for her to be good, she has to be legitimated by a man, because no woman can be legitimate by herself. So she either has to have a father or a brother or a husband or a son under whose authority she is functioning legitimately. Because if she's just like, and Susanna, you know, sold, you know, dresses, and, you know, made a really good business and, you know, was living in Babylon, you'd be like, ah, she's a whore. Shame on her. How dare she not, you know, whatever to her husband. So even though it's the book of Susanna, first sentence, we're not introduced to her. Just saying.
Great point.
Mm-hmm.
He married the daughter of Hilkiah, named Susanna, a very beautiful woman and one who feared the Lord.
So, okay. So not only is she married to the prime person, who plays almost no role in this.
But... drum roll.
She is the daughter of Hilkiah, who is a priest, right? And if I'm not mistaken, there's a Hilkiah that goes all the way back to the temple in Jerusalem. And so Yeah. So it's connecting her to old, legitimate, pre-exilic,
right,
kosher, everything is good, clean line. And he, and she's, right, so she is clean, she's connected, she's kosher, she's married, so she's, you know, yep. not some.
She fears the Lord, she's trained in the law of Moses.
And so the law of Moses is already a thing.
Great. Absolutely.
Right?
Right.
So it's a thing. And when the law of Moses becomes a thing is one of the discussion points, right? So Ezra and Nehemiah, I think, kind of refer to it. And of course, by the time of Jesus, it's definitely a thing and it's being read out loud. Where and when it becomes the thing and what thing the law of Moses at that time is unclear. So is the book of, is the law of Moses the book of Deuteronomy? Is it the Torah, which is Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus,
right.
Numbers, Deuteronomy? Is it some part of that? We don't know what constitutes the law of Moses, but she's following it,
right?
And that is a marker of who and what she is. Not only is she beautiful, she's very beautiful, and because it's in Greek, I don't know what kind of beautiful it is, and if it's the kind of beautiful that marks Sarah, or it's the kind of beautiful that marks Rebecca, or if it's the kind of beautiful that marks Rachel, and they're different kinds of beautiful, and they're still beautiful, but usually women, it only refers to their looks if it becomes part of the story, like some moving part of the story, and while we live in Southern California and beauty is everything, in the ancient world, beauty got you in big trouble. Right. And so Sarah was at risk because she was beautiful. One could argue Jacob was only interested in Rachel because she was beautiful. Tamar was beautiful and it got her raped by her brother. Right. So beauty and Esther wins the beauty contest and then she gets married to the Persian king. And one could debate how good that is. Right. Because, you know, depending on where you want to go with that, right?
It
ends up saving her people, but how good was it for her is sort of the debated point, right? And so that she is beautiful is sort of giving us a hint that that's going to become an issue, right? Because if she was the daughter of Hilkiah and she feared the Lord and she followed the law of Moses, that's all she needs to do. And so the fact that she's beautiful is by definition like – and something's going to go down because of this, right? Which is, of course, what happens, right?
Get ready.
Get ready, right? Because her beauty's going to get her in trouble. Because that's what beauty does. Anything? Read that sentence again. Sorry.
Actually, I skipped one. He married the daughter of Hilkiah named Susanna, a very beautiful woman and one who feared the Lord.
Right.
Her parents were righteous.
Okay.
And had trained their daughter according to the law of Moses.
Okay. So, and then there's that righteousness bit. Mm-hmm. And that's, righteousness is good, right?
Yeah.
And so what we get from that is, you know, she's like, she's probably a straight A student and got like, you know, 1600 on her whatever.
Right. And she's beautiful.
And she's beautiful, right? And that's where the problem is going to come in.
Oh, here goes some. Okay, here goes. All right. So verse 4, Joachim was very rich and he had a fine garden adjoining his house. The Jews used to come to him because he was the most honored of them all.
Okay.
Verse 5.
Oh, wait. So, and that's still in verse 4. So again, they're setting this up almost like Job, which most people would argue is late, right? And it's this whole notion of, so he's smart and he's good and he's rich. So something bad's got to happen, right? Because it is easy to be good when you're rich,
right?
Even though it doesn't keep you good, right? But or that's the modern world. Sorry, but this notion that that you know, one sign that the deity is pleased with you is that you become wealthy. And in the Job contest, it's like, oh, well, let's mess with that and see what happens, right?
Right.
But clearly there, you know, once upon a time, there was a happy family and everything was good. And then X is going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
It's actually really interesting to hear you say that. And I'm going to misquote this now, but, you know, Claude Levi Strauss had this he made up this equation to see if stories were related or derivatives of each other. And it's like, A plus B equals C,
right?
But A2 plus B2 equals C2. And if you switch around some of the motifs, so for example, righteous Israelite marries non-Israelite equals bad outcome.
Right.
But when you negate some of those things, unrighteous Israelite marries Israelite equals good outcome.
Right.
You can prove the stories are related. So according to Strauss, Susanna, Judith, and I guess Ruth would be derivatives of each other somehow or related,
right,
which I thought was interesting, especially considering what
right
you just mentioned as motifs. Beauty,
right,
something bad is coming.
Right.
Righteous Israelite, something bad is coming.
Right. And in this case, you have good Israelite, of pure good Israelite,
right,
everything is good, right? So they're like the,
right,
the, you know, whereas in the Moabite case, it's good Israelite marries a Moabite.
Absolutely.
Oh my God, shoot me now, right? Like,
right,
what is he thinking? And then they are in financial distress, right?
Right.
How could this have a good ending,
right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, and here's Babylon, verse 5. That year, two elders from the people were appointed as judges. Concerning them, the Lord had said, wickedness came forth from Babylon, from elders who were judges, who were supposed to govern the people. And I should note that the comment in Oxford is that verse is not in the Bible. Wickedness come from Babylon, from elders who were judges who were supposed to govern the people. That quote, it doesn't occur anywhere else in the Bible. So it's that only happens in Susanna.
Oh. So they're not borrowing that from somewhere else. And of course, that's interesting from a number of perspectives, because we have bad priests, we have bad judges, and it's interesting too because it's in Greek, so it's unclear which Hebrew word
mm-hmm
it's taking judge from. And of course, there are in the book of Judges, the judges aren't like, you know, sitting in a law court judges,
right, right,
with the exception of Deborah, but they're actually sort of like military leaders.
Right.
Right. And here they're overtly stating that the badness is coming from Babylon, which is what we talked about earlier, right? So Babylon frames everything, but you're not supposed to want to stay there, even though that's what happens,
right?
Right, and
right,
that's probably where it's written, right? You know, and the influence of Babylon on the text are sort of clear in a lot of different places,
right? Right,
and again, that's the big problem of being in exile is you're surrounded by other groups, and what do you do with that? The irony, of course, is if you're in Egypt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, we don't know for what audience this was originally written, right?
Right.
So if this is written for the Jews of Babylon, right, they're going to hear that one way. The Jews of Egypt are going to hear it a totally different way. Yeah, like, yeah, that's
right,
why we're in Egypt,
right,
right? Or that's why we're in Palestine,
right,
or that's why
we got to stay strong, stick
right,
it out.
Right, and how you're going to interpret that is going to be different based on where you are and how you define Babylon, right?
Passage in Texas is going to mean different than a passage in New York City is going to mean something different than in Seattle.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. So the fact that, you know, Babylon is the problem. Are you interpreting any foreign government as Babylon anywhere? You know, there's just multiple
absolutely
places where that can go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But
okay,
they're all bad.
So I want to get somewhere.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Because I know earlier.
You didn't tell me that we had to get somewhere.
no,
you
I,
just said,
well, I did on
say
purpose
something.
So earlier I said that I think there are things in here that definitely feel concocted, but there are also things in here that feel historical, like there's some overlay with other things. And I want to get to one of those verses because I know you have comments
okay
on that.
Okay.
So to paraphrase, Susanna's beautiful.
Correct.
She's married to Joachim.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone goes there to have their court proceedings. All the Jewish folks get there because Joachim is rich and, you know.
Smart.
And these two
and
elders.
Good.
And good. And righteous.
He's good, right?
These two elders who are wicked with the Babylonian influence, they notice that Susanna's beautiful,
yeah,
and they know that she bathes in the garden after everyone leaves for lunch every day.
Perverts.
So one day, absolutely, one day they say, let's go get lunch. Everyone leaves and the two elders say, let's go get lunch. And then they both sneak back and run into each other and they they make each other tell each other why. And they said, well, it's because we're lusting after Susanna. So they come up with this plan to hide in the garden. So one day Susanna's bathing in the garden and she sends her two maids. She says, go get me olive oil get me soap, whatever. And the elders are hiding in the garden. So once the two maids leave, and I'll read this verse because
it.
It's really weird.
Read it.
Okay, once, referring to the elders, once while they were watching for an opportune day, she went in as before
so
with only two maids.
Too.
Absolutely.
Right? It's not just that they're stalking. And it's premeditated.
Yeah. And they know she does this regularly. Verse 16, no one was there except the two elders who had hidden themselves and were watching her. She said to her maids, bring me olive oil and ointments and shut the garden doors so that I can bathe. They did as she had told them. They shut the doors of the garden and went out by the side doors to bring what they had been commanded. They did not see the elders because they were hiding. When the maids had gone out.
Well, at least they did that right.
Mm-hmm, the two elders got up and ran to her. By the way, not how you do this. Not how you. The two elders got up and ran to her. They said, look, the garden doors are shut and no one can see us. We are burning with desire for you. So give your consent and lie with us. If you refuse, we will testify against you that a young man was with you. And this was why you sent your maids away.
So how is that consent?
Right. Consent to this.
Consent to this. Otherwise, we're going to do it anyway. And we're actually really going to take you down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really gross, really weird. The fact that they run up.
Well, now. And it's so creepy, right? And that's why all the and so you showed a bunch of the paintings for your paper, but starting in 1470, it's like this big, huge, like, oh, let's paint Susanna, right? And as you showed, right, she's always like in light, right? And she always super white.
Of course. Yeah.
Whatever. And she's super naked, right? And the light is on her. So her super white naked body is like the focal point for everybody. And then you've got these like creepy guys in the background sort of ogling, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like, you know, porn for the chapel, right?
Right.
And so it's legitimate because, but it's still porny. And you're looking in and one of them, she's sort of looking at you,
yeah,
almost accusing us of participating, yeah, in this creepy thing. But, and so the painters who have decided to depict this on some level are almost as creepy as the elders doing it. And the notion of like a bunch of old guys ogling at some young beauty and threatening to rape her. I mean, you just have to pick up the newspaper. Right? And so the biblical, so the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? I mean, nothing has changed. And the whole notion of, and if you say anything, we're going to accuse you. I mean, that's just like every rape trial. I mean, that's.
Turn on the news.
Turn on the news, right? And it's this old, old trope. And there it is in the Deuterocanonical apocryphal, almost biblical text.
Yeah.
Right? And so, that's a little scary and creepy, and I am not convinced. Actually, I am convinced that the way it is depicted here is not saying this is a good thing, because she's good, her husband's good, she's doing good things. They are overtly, we're not messing around. They are just bad to the bone,
absolutely,
right? We're not even pretending that they're not. Suggesting that spying on a woman bathing and then threatening to rape her and ruin her reputation is a bad thing. And yet, it keeps being done.
Yeah, I'm so glad you pointed out that, and of course we haven't finished this yet, but this is clearly a vindication of Susanna.
Yes.
She's clearly good. She's clearly right, which is, and the messed up thing is that, you know, later on when Athanasius is trying to manage all these monks out in the desert, and you know, now there's women in the fold, and where do we put them and where do we put the men? Athanasius says, keep them separate, because it'll be the woman's fault if the guys get aroused and want to try something, as was the case with Susanna. He literally quotes Susanna and says it was her fault for being beautiful that she's attacked. So we have to keep in mind that these things take on different meanings for different times. But
yeah, because when some guy wants the women to be servile, you know, and can't control himself, we have to blame the women.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I hate this, it when that happens.
This text clearly says that Susanna is good.
She's good.
So that's an obvious obfuscation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Susanna groaned and said, I am completely trapped, for if I do this, it will mean death for me. If I do not, I cannot escape your hands. I choose not to do it. I will fall into your hands rather than sin in the sight of the Lord. Okay. And
that's her being good.
Absolutely.
Right?
This next
verse. Again, she's being good. I'm not going to do this, and it's going to be on you, and I may die because of it, but I am not playing into your stupid little game.
Right, absolutely. And so these next three verses, maybe the next four, is where I think there's, you know, you can speak to the historical nature of how, you know, trials and how alleging rape happened in the ancient world. Okay. So Susanna says, you know, I'm not going to do it, I'd rather, you know, go to trial. Then Susanna cried out loud with a voice, and the two elders shouted against her. They're both shouting. And one of them ran and opened the garden doors. When the people in the house heard the shouting in the garden, they rushed in at the side door to see what had happened to her. And when the elders told their story, the servants felt very much ashamed, for they've never heard anything like this about Susanna. So the point that she cried out loud, mm-hmm. what is this, the historical significance? What's the connection there?
Okay, so according to most ancient Near Eastern law, including the Bible, if a woman yells out, if a woman is in the Bible, it's definitely this, and in the ancient Near East, I'm pretty sure it is. I'm just trying to conjure up other law codes, and I'm pretty sure it's in there. If a woman is in their home and in the city, and someone tries to rape them and they scream, then it's rape because somebody heard them. And if nobody hears them, then obviously they wanted it. Now, again, that flies in the face of rape as we know it, but at least it's an effort by the whoever's writing law in the ancient world, to suggest that if a woman screams, then it's not her fault and she's being raped and, you know, you can do something about it. Whether somebody always hears or not, that's a whole other issue. But at least the foundational notion is that there's something she can do, and that's scream, right? If it happens according to the biblical text, if it happens out in the country and a woman says it's rape, you kind of have to believe her because if she screams, so what, right? So then it's rape. If she's in the city and she doesn't scream out, then she is an adulteress, right? And so it matters. Now, then you have, for example, the Tamar, who walks out screaming and whatever, and nobody does anything. Tamar, not the one in Genesis, but David's daughter, right? But the notion is that if a woman is in the city, she has an opportunity to scream, and therefore people come running, and it can either not happen and or at least she's got proof, as it were. So in this case, the fact that she screamed out and people heard should mean automatically that she's being raped, right? She is doing, and this is proof of her goodness, she's doing absolutely every single solitary thing that she's supposed to do. And that is, I mean, A, she screams out because ew, and who wouldn't, but sometimes you can't and you're afraid or whatever. But B, that is the signal that I don't want that this is rape. Did I answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. No, okay. I think...
And again, if she's in the garden, even though she's alone, it's trying to depict it as there were people in the house.
Right. Right.
And they heard her. Right. And so this one is like open and shut rape. She screamed out. They came running because she screamed out. And that's why they even knew what was happening. So there shouldn't even be a conversation after this point.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's especially interesting considering that this is written for Jews who have forgotten how to read Hebrew.
Yes.
But it mentions law.
Yes.
That the appropriate proceedings.
Correct.
So it speaks to this hearkening back and holding on to appropriateness in a time that's changing.
Correct. And that's what one might argue that the Septuagint is translated. And one might argue that's the argument why. So a few arguments. First of all, they wanted to follow what they were. So the Jews of Alexandria wanted to continue following their tradition, legal and otherwise. And that's why they wanted the text translated, so that they could understand it, A. And that's also, to some extent, why they wanted the Latin translated into vernacular languages throughout Europe, because the reality was even the priests didn't necessarily read Latin that well.
Right.
And so what people said was in the Bible wasn't necessarily actually in the Bible, right? You know, various people, government officials and others say, oh, well, like the Bible says, blah, 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 right? And the Bible doesn't say that at all. That's not what it says. You haven't even sat down and read the Bible, but they're kind of, well, I'm paraphrasing,
cough,
right? And the Bible doesn't, right?
I sip my tea on that one.
Right? And so that's why at least translating the Bible gives you some sense of what it may mean in your vernacular language, be it English or Greek. I would also argue that, of course, as soon as you translate, you're interpreting, and so some of the legality or the nature of the beast gets lost. But at least it's an attempt by the people, and presumably the folks in Alexandria wanted to be able to follow it and wanted to be able to participate and wanted to be able to understand it. So they're like, well, let's just translate it because these guys are not going to learn Hebrew.
Right. Okay, you have a 2:30, right?
Yes.
Okay, it's 2:23.
Oh.
Let me get to...
get to where you want to go.
Let me get
I'm
to
sorry.
Just one more thing.
You messed me up with saying I'm going to be late.
There's a bunch of like actually really disturbing details. Like they bring her in front. It says they bring all of Susanna's relatives and friends and then they strip her of the veil and she's standing there naked. Everyone's crying. It's really bothering.
But
it's really stressful for everyone.
But that's what and how rape trials still function. Right, is blame the rapist. And as soon as you blame the rapist, even though they've done everything that they've been told to do, if you dig up their past and everything, the rapist, the raped woman's past or the raped man, the rapey, right, the person who was raped, you make them look bad and you re-rape them, right? And you humiliate them publicly. And while in the modern world, we don't undress them physically in court, oftentimes it's almost as though that were done. And by having to show everybody the pictures, I can be 5 minutes later, so okay. By showing people, you know, what the photos and, you know, this is what she drank and this is what she wore and this is what, you're re-raping them. And it's exactly what's going on in here. Ironically enough, the point of this is, why are you doing this? She screamed out. She did everything she was supposed to do. You know, we know what actually happened, and we know that everybody in there is wrong, right? And so she has to be humiliated publicly when she is the victim, right? How much more of an example of how horrendous that is do we need? And yet, 21st century, that still happens.
Absolutely. And to reiterate, the text is condemning these people. It says as she was veiled, the scoundrels ordered her to be unveiled so that they might feast their eyes on her beauty.
Right,
those
and then we put
her
picture up
all
over and rape her again.
Absolutely. Two more things I want to get your thoughts on.
Okay.
So she cries out twice. It's the people are with her crying. She's crying. She cries out, God, help me.
Yep.
44, the Lord heard her cry. Just as she was being led off to execution, God stirred up the Holy Spirit of a young lad named Daniel, and he shouted with a loud voice, I want no part in shedding this woman's blood.
Go Daniel.
Right. And then he separates the elders and he asks one, which tree was she under? And he says a mastic tree, which in Greek is a play on cut down, which they're about to be cut down. And he asks the other one, which tree? And he says it was the evergreen oak. So that's how he does the Sherlock Holmes things and figures out, you know,
right.
So Daniel kind of comes in and saves the day.
Correct. And Daniel's, you know, wisdom. He's
absolutely
known for being the smart guy. Figure it out.
So she's vindicated. She's exonerated. Verse 63 and 64, I want to get your thoughts on this. Hilkiah and his wife praised God for their daughter, Susanna, and so did her husband, Joachim, and all her relatives because she was found innocent of a shameful deed. Verse 64, last verse of this story. And from that day onward, Daniel had a great reputation among the people.
Stories about Susanna, and it's not about her at all. She's not in the first verse. She's not in the last verse. And it's all about Daniel and showing how smart he is. And it's not about how great Susanna is. And she's still traumatized. And she goes through this whole thing. And it's so bad that the deity has to, like, go, hello, right? And these are the leaders, right? These are people in power. These are judges. These are, right? And it feels just like everything today, right? You know, nothing has changed, right? It's always the woman's fault, and it's not about the woman.
Because they were elders of the people and judges, the assembly believed them and condemned her to death.
Right?
Seems
no
to be
one
a
listens
comment
to,
on.
No one listens to women. right? They don't count. You can't believe them. Why not? Because men are a bunch of, nothing personal, perverts, right? And can't control themselves, right? Which the text says, right? And then Athanasius is even saying, well, you know, we can't control ourselves, so let's punish the way. I mean, everybody is doing that, right?
Right.
And that's probably why they didn't want that one to make it into the book, because it's
questioning authority a little bit.
Well, and it's a little too pat too, right?
Oh yeah,
but,
for sure.
It also, this is so gross.
This one is a disturbing one. It's not a fun one to talk about, but it does bring up issues of authority and canon and orthodoxy and what's included and what's not.
Correct. Correct.
This is in that gray space, and I think we talked about how it reflects some of the social what's going on at the time, and mm-hmm. you know, explaining the world through theology at that time. But I think there's some especially pertinent stuff in here today, and it's interesting that it's in the gray area,
mm-hmm.
and you know, orthodox some or canonized in some instances and uncanonized in others. But this is a little hidden gem.
Oh yeah, no, it's great, and the other thing too is it's insular, right? So even though they're in Babylon, the Babylonians aren't involved.
Right.
They're not, no one's talking to, you know, so rape is, each community deals with it its own way. It's not a crime against the state, right? It's viewed as like your internal problem, right? Whereas, and one might argue that that's how a lot of universities deal with rape, like, we're not going to call in the authorities. We can handle this here, right? You don't need to go into the police, little girl, just because, you know, you little whore went and got raped, right? I mean, that it's that same notion, right? We'll take care of ourselves. It's just rape. It's just women. No big deal, right? We'll re-rape her in front of the council, right? You know, it's that same sort of notion. Oh, it's so awful.
This one's a hard one.
Oh, yeah.
This one's very
awful. Well, and what's difficult about it is that it's so black and white, right? So there are other texts where it's unclear who's right and wrong, right? Or in other contexts, I don't know, what would you do? Life's hard. How do we handle this? Who should do what? What's a better, you know, I'm not sure I have a better solution. This one, it's black and white. She did nothing wrong. They're a bunch of perverted guys who have power, who abuse their power to rape this woman. No question. Nobody does anything. Everyone's afraid of them. No one's going to go against them. Let's re-rape her so that everybody from 1470 on sees her naked in front of these, you know, perverts. And the story hasn't changed, right? I mean, that's, for me, the frightening part, and that's the thing that's so horrific about it. And so it's a little bit different than other stories that you have in the biblical text where it's,
mm-hmm.
it's not necessarily always clear who's mm-hmm. right and who's wrong. And this one, it is really clear. And what's so, I think, offensive about it, at least for me, is that nothing has changed, and that people have tried to use this to say that it have turned it on its head and twisted it to say something that I don't think it ever meant to say.
That's it. Well, I was.
Did
we
cover everything
answered,
you wanted?
Yeah. No, okay. My last question was going to be, why isn't this in some canons? But I think you answered it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and it's funny of where it, and so I get why it's not in the Jewish canon, because it doesn't quite fit neatly anywhere, and it's a little, you know, it's too black and white, and we like things to be more complicated, I mm-hmm. think. And it kind of fit into the Christian one, but it's about, like, Jews, right? You know, not like pre-Jews, but like actual ones, and so that's a little uncomfortable. And in order for it, I think because it's so black and white, you have to kind of turn it around to use it against women, which has been done successfully, obviously, mm-hmm. right? And so, yeah, it's a good, it's, you know, and even in some, like, it doesn't get into some canons until, so even when it gets into a canon, it gets in late.
Right?
And it's not about Susanna.
Yeah, that's the bizarre part. First and last verse will tell you everything, won't it?
Right, absolutely. And in a lot of places, it's called the 13th book of Daniel.
So, wow. Yeah.
Right?
Right, yeah.
So, oh, poor Susanna. Yeah. There's not even a good song.
You done it again, Doc.
All right, good.
Thank you. You got a dip.
All right, I got to go.
So that's the story of Susanna. It's an interesting story, to say the least. And if you want to learn more, I did this really cool video essay on my YouTube channel comparing three different paintings, representations from the Renaissance of Susanna. Just go to YouTube and search Deanie D's. It'll pop up. And if you have questions about the podcast or have topics that you'd like to hear covered, shoot me an email, genie@geniedees.tv. Just type me a message and click send. I'll catch you next time, live from Studio B3. My name's Genie, and this is Scripture Unearthed.